How did you know that? Did he tell you?
No, I said.
Hmm, he said again. Did you kneel down beside it too?
I suppose I could have. I don't think so. I don't remember.
The inspector made a note. Even without seeing it, I knew what it said. Query. Did D? 1. Tell F no pulse. 2. See F kneel BB beside body.
That's quite understandable, he said. It must have been rather a shock.
I brought to mind the image of the stranger lying there in the first light of dawn, the slight growth of whiskers on his chin, strands of his red hair shifting gently on the faint stirrings of the morning breeze, the pallor, the extended leg, the quivering fingers, that last sucking breath, and that word blown into my face, valet. The thrill of it all.
Yes, I said. It was devastating.
I had evidently passed the test. Inspector Hewitt had gone into the kitchen, where Sergeants Woolmer and Graves were busily setting up operations under a barrage of gossip and lettuce sandwiches from Mrs. Mullet. As Ophelia and Daphne came down to lunch, I noticed with disappointment Ophelia's unusual clarity of complexion. Had my concoction backfired? Had I, through some freak accident of chemistry, produced a miracle facial cream? Mrs. Mullet bustled in, grumbling as she set our soup and sandwiches on the table. "It's not right," she said. "Me already behind me time, what with all this pother, and Alf expecting me home and all. The nerve of them, axing me to dig that dead snipe out of the refuse bin," she said with a shudder. "So's they could prop it up and take its likeness. It's not right. I showed them the bin and told them if they wanted the carcass so bad, they could jolly well dig it out themselves. I had lunch to make. Eat your sandwiches, dear. There's nothing like cold meats in June. They're as good as a picnic.
Dead snipe? Daphne asked, curling her lip.
The one as Miss Flavie and the Colonel found on my yesterday's back doorstep. Oh, it still gives me the goose pimples, the way that thing was laying there with its eye all frosted and its bill sticking straight up in the air with a bit of paper stuck on it.
Ned, Ophelia said, slapping the table. Oh, you were right, Daphne, it's a love token.
Daphne had been reading The Golden Bough at Easter and told Ophelia that primitive courting customs from the South Seas sometimes survived in our own enlightened times. It was simply a matter of being patient, she said. I looked from one to the other blankly. There were whole eons when I didn't understand my sisters at all.
A dead bird, stiff as a board with its bill sticking straight up in the air, what kind of token is that? I asked.
Daphne hid behind her book, and Ophelia flushed a little. I slipped away from the table and left them tittering into their soup.
Mrs. Mullet, I said. "Didn't you tell Inspector Hewitt we never see jacksnipe in England until September?"
"Snipes, snipes, snipes. That's all I hear about nowadays is snipes. Step to one side, if you please. You're standing where it wants scrubbing."
"Why is that? Why do we never see snipe before September?"
Mrs. Mallet straightened up, dropped her brush in the bucket, and dried her soapy hands on her apron.
"Because they're somewhere else," she said triumphantly.
"Where?"
Oh, you know, they're like all them birds what emigrate. They're up north somewhere. For all I know, they could be taking tea with Father Christmas.
By up north, how far do you mean? Scotland?
Scotland, she said contemptuously.
Oh, dear, no, you might ask second sister Margaret gets as far as Scotland on her holidays, and she's no snipe.
Although her husband is, she added. There was a roaring in my ears and something went click.
"What about Norway?" I asked. "Could jacksnipe summer in Norway?"
"I suppose they could, dear. You'd have to look it up."
"Yes. Hadn't Inspector Hewitt told Dr. Darby that they had reason to believe the man in the garden had come from Norway? How could they possibly know that? Would the inspector tell me if I asked?"
"Probably not. In that case, I should have to puzzle it out for myself."
"Run along now," Mrs. Mallet said. "I can't go home till I finish this floor, and it's already 1 o'clock. poor Alf's digestion is most likely in a shocking state by now.
I stepped out the back door. The police and the coroner had gone and taken the body with them, and the garden now seemed strangely empty.
Dogger was nowhere in sight, and I sat down on a low section of the wall to have a bit of a think.
Had Ned left the dead snipe on the doorstep as a token of his love for Ophelia?
She certainly seemed convinced of it.
If it had been Ned, where did he get the thing?
2.5 seconds later, I grabbed Gladys, threw my leg over her saddle, and, for the second time that day, was flying like the wind into the village. Speed was of the essence. No one in Bishop's Lacey would yet know of the stranger's death. The police would not have told a soul, and nor had I. Not until Mrs. Mullet finished her scrubbing and walked to the village would the gossip begin. But once she reached home, news of the murder at Buckshaw would spread like the Black Death. I had until then to find out what I needed to know.
Chapter 7.
As I skidded to a stop and leaned Gladys against a pile of weathered timbers, Ned was still at work in the inn yard. He had finished with the beer barrels and was now showily unloading cheeses the size of millstones from the back of a parked lorry.
"Hi, Flavia,"
he said as he saw me, jumping at the opportunity to stop work.
"Fancy some cheese?"
Before I could answer, he had pulled a nasty-looking jackknife from his pocket and sliced off a slab of Stilton with frightening ease. He cut one for himself and tucked into it on the spot with what Daphne would call noisy gusto. Daphne is going to be a novelist and copies out into an old account book phrases that strike her in a day-to-day reading. I remembered noisy gusto from the last time I snooped through its pages.
"Been home?"
Ned asked, looking at me with a shy sideways glance. I saw what was coming.
I nodded. "And how's Miss Ophelia? Has the doctor been round?"
"Yes," I said. "I believe he saw her this morning." Ned swallowed my deception whole.
"Still green, then, is she?"
"More of a yellow than before," I said. "A shade more sulfuric than cupric." I had learned that a lie wrapped in detail, like a horse pill in an apple, went down with greater ease. But this time, as soon as I said it, I knew that I had overstepped.
"Oh, Flavia," Ned said, "you're making sport of me."
I let him have my best slow dawning country bumpkin smile.
"You've caught me out, Ned," I said, "guilty as charged."
He gave me back a weird mirror image of my grin. For a fraction of a second, I thought he was mocking me, and I felt my temper begin to rise. But then I realized he was honestly pleased to have puzzled me out. This was my opportunity.
"Ned," I said, "if I asked you a terrifically personal question, would you answer it?"
I waited as this sunk in. Communicating with Ned was like exchanging cabled messages with a slow reader in Mongolia.
"Of course I'd answer it," he said,
and the roguish twinkle in his eye tipped me off to what was coming next. "Course, I might not say the truth." When we both had a good laugh, I got down to business. I'd start with the heavy artillery.
"You're frightfully keen on Ophelia, aren't you?"
Ned sucked his teeth and ran a finger round the inside of his collar.
"She's a right nice girl, I'll give her that. But wouldn't you like to settle down with her one day in a thatched cottage and raise a litter of brats?"
By now, Ned's neck was a rising column of red, like a thick alcohol thermometer. In seconds, he looked like one of those bears that inflate its gullet for mating purposes. I decided to help him out.
"Just suppose she wanted to see you, but her father wouldn't allow it. Suppose one of her younger sisters could help."
Already his ruddy crop was subsiding. I thought he was going to cry.
"Do you mean it, Flavia? Honest Injun," I said.
Ned stuck out his calloused fingers and gave my hand a surprisingly gentle shake. It was like shaking hands with a pineapple.
"Fingers of friendship," he said, whatever that meant.
"Fingers of friendship?" Had I just been given the secret handshake of some rustic brotherhood that met in moonlit churchyards and hidden copses? Was I now inducted, and would I be expected to take part in unspeakably bloody midnight rituals in the hedgerows? It seemed like an interesting possibility. Ned was grinning at me like the skull on a Jolly Roger. I took the upper hand.
Listen, I told him, lesson number one. Don't leave dead birds on the loved one's doorstep. It's something that only a courting cat would do.
Ned looked blank.
I've left flowers once or twice, hoping she'd notice, he said.
This was news to me. Ophelia must have whisked the bouquets off to a boudoir for mooning purposes before anyone else in the household spotted them.
But dead birds? Never. You know me, Flavia. I wouldn't do a thing like that.
When I stopped to think about it for a moment, I knew that he was right. I did, and he wouldn't. My next question, though, turned out to be sheer luck.
Does Mary Stoker know you're sweet on Ophelia?
It was a phrase I had picked up at the cinema from some American film. Meet me in St. Louis, or Little Women. And this was the first opportunity I'd ever had to make use of it. Like Daphne, I remembered words, but without an account book to jot them down.
What's Mary have to do with it? She's Tully's daughter, and there's an end of it.
Come off it, Ned, I said. I saw that kiss this morning as I was passing by.
She needed a little comfort. 'Twas no more than that.
Because of whoever it was that crept up behind her.
Ned leapt to his feet. Damn you, he said. She don't want that getting out. As she was changing the sheet. You're a devil, Flavia Deluce, Ned roared. Get away from me. Go home.
Tell her, Ned, said a quiet voice, and I turned to see Mary at the door. She stood with one hand flat on the doorpost, the other clutching her blouse at the neck like Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Close up, I could see that she had raw red hands and a decided squint.
"Tell her," she repeated, "it can't make any difference to you now, can it?"
I detected instantly that she didn't like me. It's a fact of life that a girl can tell in a flash if another girl likes her. Feely says that there is a broken telephone connection between men and women, and we can never know which one of us rang off. With a boy, you never know whether he's smitten or gagging, but with a girl, you can tell in the first 3 seconds. Between girls, there is a silent and unending flow of invisible signals, like the high-frequency wireless messages between the shore and the ships at sea, and this secret flow of dots and dashes was signalling that Mary detested me.
"Go on, tell her!"
Mary shouted. Ned swallowed hard and opened his mouth, but nothing came out.
"You're Flavia Deluce, aren't you?" she said. "One of that lot from up at Buckshaw."
She flung it at me like a pie in the face. I nodded dumbly, as if I was some inbred ingrate from the squire's estate who needed coddling. Better to play along, I thought.
"Come with me," Mary said, beckoning. "Be quick about it, and keep quiet."
I followed her into a dark stone larder, and then into an enclosed wooden staircase that spiraled precipitously up to the floor above. At the top, we stepped out into what must have once been a linen press, a tall square cupboard now filled with shelves of cleaning chemicals, soaps and waxes. In the corner, mops and brooms leaned in disarray amid an overwhelming smell of carbolic disinfectant.
"Shh," she said, giving my arm a vicious squeeze.
Heavy footsteps were approaching, coming up the same staircase we had just ascended. We pressed back into a corner, taking care not to knock over the mops.
"That'll be the bloody day, sir, when a Cotswold horse takes the bloody purse. If I was you, I'd take a flutter on Sea Star. Be damned to any tips you get from some bloody scout in London. What don't know his ark from his halo?"
It was Tully, exchanging confidential turf tips with someone at a volume loud enough to be heard at Epsom Downs. Another voice muttered something that ended in "oh," as the sound of their footsteps faded away in the warren of panelled passages.
"No, this way," Mary hissed, tugging at my arm.
We slipped round the corner and into a narrow corridor. She pulled a set of keys from her pocket and quietly unlocked the last door on the left. We stepped inside. We were in a room which had not likely changed since Queen Elizabeth visited Bishop Lacy in 1592 on one of her summer progresses. My first impressions were of a timbered ceiling, plastered panels, a tiny window with leaded panes standing ajar for air, and broad floorboards that rose and fell like the ocean swell. Against one wall was a chipped wooden table with an ABC railway guide, October 1946, shoved under one leg to keep it from teetering. On the tabletop were an unmatched Staffordshire pitcher and ewer in pink and cream, a comb, a brush, and a small black leather case. In a corner near the open window stood a single piece of luggage, a cheap-looking steamer trunk of vulcanized fibre, plastered over with coloured stickers. Beside it was a straight chair with a missing spindle. Across the room stood a wooden wardrobe of jumble sale quality. And the bed.
"This is it," Mary said.
As she locked us in, I turned to look at her closely for the first time. In the grey dishwater light from the sooty window panes, she looked older, harder, and more brittle than the raw-handed girl I had just seen in the bright sunlight of the inn-yard.
"I expect you've never been in a room this small, have you?" she said scornfully. "You lot at Buckshaw fancy the odd visit to Bedlam, don't you? See the loonies, see how we live in our cages, throw us a biscuit."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said. Mary turned her face towards me so that I was receiving the full intensity of her glare.
"That sister of yours, that Ophelia, sent you with a message for Ned, and don't tell me she didn't. She fancies I'm some kind of slattern, and I'm not."
And in that instant, I decided that I liked Mary, even if she didn't like me. Anyone who knew the word slattern was worth cultivating as a friend.
"Listen," I said, "there's no message. What I said to Ned was strictly for cover. Oh, you have to help me, Mary. I know you will. There's been a murder at Buckshaw."
"There, I'd said it. And nobody knows it yet but you and me. Except the murderer, of course." She looked at me for no more than 3 seconds and then she asked,
"Who is it that's dead then?"
"I don't know. That's why I'm here. But it makes sense to me that if someone turns up dead in the cucumbers, and even the police don't know who he is, the most likely place he'd be staying in the neighbourhood, if he was staying in the neighbourhood, is right here at the 13 Drakes.
Can you bring me the register?"
"Don't need to bring it to you," Mary said. "There's only one guest right now, and that's Mr. Sanders." The more I talked to Mary, the more I liked her.
"And this is his room," she added helpfully.
"Where is he from?" I asked. Her face clouded.
"I don't know rightly."
"Has he ever stopped here before?"
"Not so far as I know."
"Then I need to have a look at the register. Please, Mary, please, it's important. The police will soon be here and then it will be too late."
"I'll try," she said, and, unlocking the door, slipped from the room.
As soon as she was gone, I pulled open the door of the wardrobe. Except for a pair of wooden coat hangers, it was empty, and I turned my attention to the steamer trunk, which was covered over with stickers like barnacles clinging to the hull of a ship. These colourful crustaceans, however, had names. Paris, Rome, Stockholm, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Stavanger, and more. I tried the hasp, and to my surprise it popped open. It was unlocked. The two halves, hinged in the middle, swung easily apart, and I found myself face to face with Mr. Sanders' wardrobe. A blue serge suit, two shirts, a pair of brown Oxfords. With blue serge? Even I knew better than that. And a floppy theatrical hat that reminded me of photographs I'd seen of G.K. Chesterton in the Radio Times. I pulled out the drawers of the trunk, taking care not to disturb their contents. A pair of hairbrushes, imitation tortoise shell, a razor, valet auto strop, a tube of shaving cream, Morning Pride brushless, a toothbrush, toothpaste, Thymol, specially recommended to arrest the germs of dental decay. Nail clippers, a straight comb, Silanite, and a pair of square cufflinks, Whippy Jet with a pair of initials inset in silver, H.B.
H.B.? Wasn't this Mr. Sanders' room? What could H.B. stand for?
The door flew open and a voice hissed, "What are you doing?" I nearly flew out of my skin. It was Mary.
"I couldn't get the register. Dad was..."
"Flavia, you can't go through a guest's luggage like that. You'll get both of us in a pickle. Stop it." "Righto," I said, as I finished rifling the pockets of the suit. They were empty anyway.
"What was the last time you saw Mr. Sanders?"
"Yesterday, here," at noon.
Here? In this room?
She gulped and nodded, looking away.
I was changing his sheets when he come up behind me and grabbed me, put a hand over my mouth so I shouldn't scream.
Good job Dad called from the yard just then. Rattled him a bit, it did. Don't think I didn't get in a good kick or two. Him and his filthy paws. I'd have scratched his eyes out if I'd had half the chance.
She looked at me as if she'd said too much, as if a great social gulf had suddenly opened up between us.
I'd have scratched his eyes out and sucked the holes, I said.
Her eyes widened in horror.
John Marston, I told her, the Dutch courtesan, 1604. There was a pause of approximately 200 years. Then Mary began to giggle.
Oh, you are a one, she said.
The gap had been bridged.
Act two, I added.
Seconds later, the two of us were doubled over, hands covering our mouths, hopping about the room, snorting in unison like a pair of trained seals.
Feely once read it to us under the blankets with a torch, I said,
and for some reason this struck both of us as being even more hilarious, and off we went again until we were nearly paralysed from laughter. Mary threw her arms around me and gave me a crushing hug.
You're a corker, Flavia, she said. Really you are.
Come here, take a gander at this.
She went to the table, picked up the black leather case, unfastened the strap and lifted the lid. Nestled inside were two rows of 6 little glass vials, 12 in all. 11 were filled with a liquid of a yellowish tinge. The 12th was a quarter full. Between the rows of vials was a half-round indentation, as if some tubular object were missing.
What do you make of it?
She whispered, as Tully's voice thundered vaguely in the distance.
Poisons, you think? A regular Dr. Crippen, our Mr. Sanders.
I uncorked the partially filled bottle and held it to my nose. It smelled as if someone had dropped vinegar on the back of a sticking plaster. An acrid protein smell, like an alcoholic's hair burning in the next room.
Insulin, I said. He's a diabetic.
Mary gave me a blank look, and I suddenly knew how Archimedes felt when he said Eureka in his bathtub. I grabbed Mary's arm.
Does Mr. Sanders have red hair? I demanded.
Red as rhubarb! How did you know? She stared at me as if I were Madame Zolanda at the church fete, with a turban, a shawl, and a crystal ball.
A wizard guess, I said.
Chapter 8
Crikey, Mary said, fishing under the table and pulling out a round metal waste paper basket. I almost forgot this. Dad'd have my hide for a hammock if he found out I didn't empty this thing. He's always on about germs, Dad is, even though you wouldn't think it to look at him. Good job I remembered before.
Oh, God, just look at this mess, will you?
She pulled a wry face and held out the basket at arm's length. I peeked tentatively inside. You never know what you're getting into when you stick your nose in other people's rubbish. The bottom of the waste basket was covered with chunks and flakes of pastry. No container, just bits flung in, as if whoever had been eating it had had enough. It appeared to be the remains of a pie. As I reached in and extracted a piece of it, Mary made a gacking noise and turned her head away.
Look at this, I said. It's a piece of the crust, see? It's golden brown here from the oven, with little crinkles of pastry, like decorations on one side. These other bits are from the bottom crust. They're whiter and thinner, not very flaky, is it?
Still, I added, I'm famished. When you haven't eaten all day, anything looks good.
I raised the pie and opened my mouth, pretending I was about to gobble it down.
Flavia!
I paused with a crumbling cargo halfway to my gaping mouth.
Hmm?
Oh, you... Mary said,
give it over, I'll chuck it.
Something told me this was a bad idea. Something else told me that the gutted pie was evidence that should be left untouched for Inspector Hewitt and the two sergeants to discover. I actually considered this for a moment.
Got any paper? I asked.
Mary shook her head. I opened the wardrobe and, standing on tiptoe, felt along the top shelf with my hand. As I suspected, a sheet of newspaper had been put in place to serve as a makeshift shelf liner.
God bless you, Tully Stoker. Taking care not to break them, I tipped the larger remnants of the pie slowly out onto the Daily Mail and folded it up into a small, neat package, which I shoved into my pocket. Mary stood watching me nervously, not saying a word. "Lab test," I said darkly. To tell the truth, I didn't have any idea yet what I was going to do with this revolting stuff. I'd think of something later, but right now I wanted to show Mary who was in charge. As I set the waste paper basket down on the floor, I was startled at a sudden slight movement in its depths, and I don't mind admitting that my stomach turned a primal handspring. What was in there? Worms? A rat? Impossible. I couldn't have missed something that big. I peered cautiously into the container, and sure enough, something was moving at the bottom of the basket. A feather. And it was moving gently, almost imperceptibly, back and forth with the room's air currents, stirring like a dead leaf on a tree, in the same way the dead stranger's red hair had stirred in the morning breeze. Could it have been only this morning that he died? It seemed an eternity since the unpleasantness in the garden. Unpleasantness? You liar, Flavia. Mary looked on aghast as I reached into the basket and extracted the feather and the bit of pastry impaled upon its quill end. See this, I said, holding it out towards her. She shrank back in the way Dracula is supposed to do when you threaten him with a cross. If the feather had fallen on the pastry in the waste paper basket, it wouldn't be attached. 24 blackbirds baked in a pie, I recited. See? You think? Mary asked, her eyes like saucers. Bang on, Sherlock, I said. This pie's filling was bird, and I think I can guess the species. I held it out to her again. What a pretty dish to set before the king, I said, and this time she grinned at me. I'd do the same with Inspector Hewitt, I thought, as I pocketed the thing. Yes, I'd solve this case and present it to him wrapped up in gaily coloured ribbons. No need for you to come out here again, he'd said to me in the garden. That sauce pot, what bloody cheek! Well, I'd show him a trick or two. Something told me that Norway was the key. Ned hadn't been in Norway, and besides, he had sworn he didn't leave the snipe on our doorstep, and I believed him, so he was out of the question, at least for now. The stranger had come from Norway, and I had heard that straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Ergo, that means therefore, the stranger could have brought the snipe with him. In a pie? Yes, that made sense. What better way to get a dead bird past an inquisitive HM customs inspector? Just one more step and we're home free. If the inspector can't be asked how he knew about Norway, and nor can the stranger, obviously, since he is dead, who, then, does that leave? And I suddenly saw it all, saw it spread out before me at my feet the way one must see from the top of a mountain. The way Harriet must have. The way an eagle sees his prey. I hugged myself with pleasure. If the stranger had come from Norway, dropped a dead bird on our doorstep before breakfast, and then appeared in Father's study after midnight, he must have been staying somewhere not far away. Somewhere within walking distance of Buckshaw. Somewhere such as right here in this very room at the 13 Drakes. Now I knew it for certain. The corpse in the cucumbers was Mr. Sanders. There could be no doubt about it. Mary! It was Tully again, bellowing like a bull calf, and this time it seemed he was right outside the door. Coming, Dad! She shouted, grabbing the wastebasket. Get out of here, she whispered. Wait 5 minutes and then go down the back stairs, same way as we came up. She was gone, and then a moment later I heard her explaining to Tully in the hallway that she just wanted to give the wastebasket an extra clean-out, since someone left a mess in it. We wouldn't want somebody to die of germs they picked up at the 13 Drakes, would we, Dad? She was learning. While I waited, I took a second look at the steamer trunk. I ran my fingers over the coloured labels, trying to imagine where it had been in its travels, and what Mr. Sanders had been doing in each city. Paris, Rome, Stockholm, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Stavanger. Paris was red, white and blue, and so was Stavanger. Was Stavanger in France? I wondered. It didn't sound French, unless, of course, it was pronounced Stavanger, as in Laurence Olivier. I touched the label and it wrinkled beneath my finger, piled up like water ahead of the prow of a ship. I repeated the test on the other stickers. Each one was pasted down tightly, as smooth as a label on a bottle of cyanide. Back to Stavanger. It felt a little lumpier than the others, as if there was something underneath it. The blood was humming in my veins like water in a mill race. Again I pried the trunk open and took the safety razor from the drawer. As I extracted the blade, I thought how lucky it was that women, other than the occasional person like Miss Pickery at the library, don't need to shave. It was tough enough being a woman without having to lug all that tackle everywhere you went. Holding the blade carefully between my thumb and forefinger, after the glassware incident, I had been loudly lectured about sharp objects. I made a slit along the bottom of the label, taking great care to cut along the precise edge of a blue and red decorative line that ran nearly the full width of the paper. As I lifted the incision slightly with the dull edge of the blade, something slid out and, with a whisper of paper, fell to the floor. It was a glassine envelope, similar to the ones I had noticed in Sergeant Graves' kit. Through its semi-transparency, I could see that there was something inside, something square and opaque. I opened the envelope and gave it a tap with my finger. Something fell out into the palm of my hand. Two somethings, in fact. Two postage stamps. Two bright orange postage stamps, each in its own tiny translucent jacket. Aside from their colour, they were identical to the penny black that had been impaled upon the jacksnipe's bill. Queen Victoria's face again. What a disappointment. I didn't doubt that Father would have gone into positive raptures about the pristine perfection of the things, the enchantment of engraving, the pleasures of perforations, and the glories of glue. But to me they were no more than the sort of thing you'd slap on a letter to dreadful Aunt Felicity in Hampshire, thanking her for her thoughtful Christmas gift of a Neddy the Squirrel annual. Still, why bother putting them back? If Mr. Sanders and the body in our garden were, as I knew they were, one and the same, he was well past the need for postage stamps. No, I thought, I'll keep the things. They might come in handy some day when I need to barter my way out of a scrape with Father, who is incapable of thinking stamps and discipline at the same time. I shoved the envelope into my pocket, licked my forefinger, and moistened the inside edge of the slit in the label on the trunk. Then, with my thumb, I ironed it shut. No one, not even Inspector Fabian of the Yard, could ever guess it had been sliced open. My time was up. I took one last look around the room, slipped out into the dim hallway, and, as Mary had instructed me, moved carefully towards the back staircase.
"You're about as useless as tights on a bull, Mary. How the bloody hell can I stay on top of things when you're letting everything go to hell in a handbasket?"
Tully was coming up the back way. One more turning of the stairs and we'd be face to face. I flew on tiptoe in the other direction, through the twisting, turning labyrinth of corridors, up two steps here, down three there. A moment later, panting, I found myself at the top of the L-shaped staircase that led down to the front entrance. As far as I could see, there was no one below. I tiptoed down, one slow step at a time. A long hallway, hung profusely with dark, water-stained sporting prints, served as a lobby in which centuries of sacrificed kippers had left the smell of their smoky souls clinging to the wallpaper. Only the patch of sunshine visible through the open front door relieved the gloom. To my left was a small desk with a telephone directory, a small glass vase of red and mauve pansies, and a ledger. The register! Obviously, the 13 Drakes was not a busy beehive. Its open pages bore the names of travellers who had signed in for the past week and more. I didn't even have to touch the thing. There it was. 2nd of June, 10:25 a.m., FX Sanders, London. No other guests had registered the day before, and none since. But London? Inspector Hewitt had said that the dead man had come from Norway, and I knew that, like King George, Inspector Hewitt was not a frivolous man. Well, he hadn't said exactly that. He'd said that the deceased had recently come from Norway, which was a horse of an entirely different hue. Before I could think this through, there was a banging from above. It was Tully again, the ubiquitous Tully. I could tell by his tone that Mary was still getting the worst of it.
"Don't look at me like that, my girl, or I'll give you reason to regret it."
And now he was clomping heavily down the main staircase. In another few seconds, he'd see me. Just as I was about to make a bolt for the front door, a battered black taxicab stopped directly in front of it, the roof piled high with luggage and the wooden legs of a photographer's tripod protruding from one of its windows. Tully was distracted for a moment.
"He's Mr. Pemberton," he said in a stage whisper. "He's early. Now then, girl, I told you this would happen, didn't I? Get a move on and dump those dirty sheets while I find Ned."
I ran for it, straight back past the sporting prints, into the back vestibule, and out into the inn yard.
"Ned, come and get Mr. Pemberton's luggage."
Tully was right behind me, following me towards the back of the inn. Although momentarily dazzled by the bright sunlight, I could see that Ned was nowhere about. He must have finished unloading the lorry and gone on to other duties. Without even thinking about it, I sprang up and into the back of the lorry, lay down and flattened myself behind a pile of cheeses. Peering out from between the stacked rounds, I saw Tully stride out into the inn yard, look round, and mop his red face with his apron. He was dressed for pumping pints. The bar must be open, I thought.
"Ned!" he bellowed.
I knew that, standing in the bright sunlight as he was, he could not see me in the lorry's dim interior. All I had to do was lie low and keep quiet. I was thinking that when a couple more voices were added to Tully's bellowing.
"Watch here, Tully," one said. "Thanks for the pint." "S'long, mate," said the other. "See you next Saturday." "Tell George he can hang his shirt on C-Star. Just don't tell him which shirt."
It was one of those stupid things men say simply to get in the last word. There was nothing remotely funny about it. Still, they all laughed and were probably slapping their legs at the witticism, and a moment later I felt the lorry dip on its springs as the two climbed heavily into the cab. Then the engine grated into life and we began to move. Backwards. Tully was folding and unfolding his fingers, beckoning the lorry as it reversed, indicating with his hands the clearance between its tailgate and the inn-yard wall. I couldn't jump out now without leaping straight into his arms. I'd have to wait until we drove out through the archway and turned onto the open road. My last glimpse of the yard was of Tully walking back towards the door and Gladys leaning where I had left her against a pile of scrap lumber. As the lorry veered sharply and then accelerated, I was beamed by a wheel of toppling Wensleydale and followed it sliding across a rough wooden floor. By the time I'd braced myself, the high road behind us was flashing by in a blur of green hedges, and Bishop's Lacey was receding in the distance. "Now you've done it, Flav," I thought. "You might never see your family again." As attractive as this idea seemed at first, I realized quickly that I would miss Father, at least a little. Ophelia and Daphne I would soon learn to live without. Inspector Hewitt would, of course, have already jumped to the conclusion that I had committed the murder, fled the scene, and was making my way by tramp steamer to British Guiana. He would have alerted all ports to keep an eye out for an 11-year-old murderess in pigtails and sweater. Once they put two and two together, the police would soon set the hounds to tracking a fugitive who smelt like an old world cheese shop. I would need to find a place to take a bath then, a meadow stream perhaps, where I could wash my clothes and dry them on a bramble bush. They would, naturally, interview Tully, grill Ned and Mary, and find out my means of escape from the 13 Drakes. The 13 Drakes. Why is it, I wondered, that the men who choose the names of our inns and public houses are so desperately unimaginative? The 13 Drakes, Mrs. Mullet had once told me, was given its name in the 18th century by a landlord who simply counted up 12 other licensed drakes in nearby villages and added another. Why not something of practical value, like the 13 carbon atoms, for instance, something that could be used as a memory aid? There were 13 carbon atoms in Tridesil, whose hydride was marsh gas. What a jolly useful name for a pub! The 13 Drakes, indeed. Leave it to a man to name a place for a bird. I was still thinking about Tridesel when, at the open tailgate of the lorry, a rounded whitewashed stone flashed by. It had a familiar look, and I realized almost at once that it was the turn-off marker for Doddingsley. In another half mile, the driver would be forced to stop, even if only for a moment, before turning either right to St. Elfrida's or left to Nether Lacey. I slithered to the lip of the open box just as the brakes squealed and the vehicle began to slow. A moment later, like a commando being sucked out the drop hole of a Whitley bomber, I slipped off the tailgate and hit the dirt on all fours. Without a backwards glance, the driver turned to the left, and as the heavy lorry and its load of cheeses lumbered away in a cloud of dust, I set off for home. It was going to be a fair old trudge across the fields to Buckshaw. Chapter 9. I expect that long after my sister Ophelia is dead and gone, whenever I think of her, the first memory that will come to mind will be her gentle touch at the piano. Seated at the keyboard of her old Broadwood grand in the drawing room, Feely becomes a different person. Years of practice, come hell or high water, have given her the left hand of a Joe Lewis and the right hand of a Beau Brummel, or so Daffy says. Because she plays so beautifully, I have always felt it my bounden duty to be particularly rotten to her. For instance, when she's playing one of those early things by Beethoven that sounds as if it's been cribbed from Mozart, I will stop at the drop of a hat, whatever I may be doing, to stroll casually through the drawing room. "First-rate flipper work," I'll say loudly enough to be heard above the music. "Off, off, off!" Ophelia has milky blue eyes, the sort of eyes I like to imagine blind Homer might have had. Although she has most of her repertoire off by heart, she occasionally shifts herself on the piano bench, folds a bit forward at the waist like an automaton, and has a good squint at the sheet music. Once, when I remarked that she looked like a disoriented bandicoot, she leaped up from the piano bench and beat me within an inch of my life with a rolled-up piano sonata by Schubert. Ophelia has no sense of humour. As I climbed over the last stile and Buckshaw came into view across the field, it almost took my breath away. It was from this angle and at this time of day that I loved it most. As I approached from the west, the mellow old stone glowed like saffron in the late afternoon sun, well settled into the landscape like a complacent mother hen squatting on her eggs, with the Union Jack stretching itself contentedly overhead. The house seemed unaware of my approach, as if I were an intruder creeping up on it. Even from a quarter of a mile away, I could hear the notes of the toccata by Pietro Domenico Paradisi, the one from his sonata in A major, come tripping out to meet me. The toccata was my favourite composition. To my mind, it was the greatest musical accomplishment in the entire history of the world. But I knew that if Ophelia found that out, she would never play the piece again. Whenever I hear this music, it makes me think of flying down the steep east side of Gouger Hill, running so fast that my legs can barely keep up with themselves as I swoop from side to side, mewing into the wind like a rapturous seagull. When I was closer to the house, I stopped in the field and listened to the perfect flow of notes. Not too presto, just the way I liked it. I thought of the time I heard Eileen Joyce play the toccata on the BBC Home Service. Father had switched it on, not really listening, as he fiddled with his stamp collection. The notes had found their way through the corridors and galleries of Buckshaw, floated up the spiral staircase and into my bedroom. By the time I realized what was being played, raced down the stairs and burst into Father's study, the music had ended. We had stood there looking at one another, Father and I, not knowing what to say, until at last, without a word, I had backed out of the room and gone slowly back upstairs. That's the only problem with the toccata. It's too short. I came round the fence and onto the terrace. Father was sitting at his desk in the window of his study, intent on whatever it was he was working at. The Rosicrucians claim in their adverts that you can make a total stranger turn round in a crowded cinema by fixing your gaze intently on the back of his neck, and I stared at him for all I was worth. He glanced up, but he did not see me. His mind was somewhere else. I didn't move a muscle. And then, as if his head were made of lead, he looked down and went on with his work, and in the drawing room, Feely moved on to something by Schumann. Whenever she was thinking about Ned, Feely played Schumann. I suppose that's why they call it romantic music. Once when she was playing a Schumann sonata with an excessively dreamy look on her face, I heard remark loudly to Daffy that I simply adored bandstand music, and Feely flew into a passion that wasn't helped by my stalking out of the room and returning a few minutes later with a Bakelite ear trumpet I had found in a closet, a tin cup, and a hand-lettered sign tied round my neck with a string. Deafened in tragic piano accident. Please take pity. Feely had probably forgotten that incident by now, but I hadn't. As I pretended to push past her to look out the window, I had a fleeting close-up of her face. Drat! Nothing for my notebook again. "You're probably in trouble," she said, slamming down the lid on the keyboard. "Where have you been all day?" "None of your horse nails," I told her. "I'm not in your employ." "Everyone's been looking for you. Daffy and I told them you'd run away from home. But no such bloody luck by the look of it." "It's bloody poor form to say bloody, Feely. You're not supposed to. And don't puff out your cheeks like that. It makes you look like a petulant pear." "Where's Father?" As if I didn't know. "He hasn't stuck his nose out all day," Daffy said. "Do you suppose he's upset about what happened this morning?" "The corpse on the premises? No, I shouldn't say so. Nothing to do with him, is it?" "That's what I thought," Feely said, and lifted the piano lid. With a toss of her hair, she was off into the first of Bach's Goldberg Variations. It was slow, but lovely nonetheless, although even on his best days, Bach, to my way of thinking, couldn't hold a candle to Pietro Domenico Paradisi. And then I remembered Gladys. I had left her at the 13th Drakes, where she could be spotted by anyone. If the police hadn't been there already, they soon would be. I wondered if by now Mary or Ned had been made to tell them of my visit. But if they had, I reasoned, wouldn't Inspector Hewitt be at Buckshaw this very moment reading me the riot act? 5 minutes later, for the third time that day, I was on my way to Bishop's Lacey, this time on foot. By keeping to the hedgerows and skulking behind trees whenever I heard the sound of an approaching vehicle, I was able to make my way, by a devious route, to the far end of the high street which, this late in the day, was deep in its usual empty sleep. A shortcut through Miss Bewdley's ornamental garden, water lilies, stone stalks, goldfish, and a red lacquered footbridge, brought me to the brick wall that skirted the inn yard at the 13 Drakes, where I crouched and listened. Gladys, if no one had moved her, was directly on the other side. Except for the hum of a far-off tractor, there wasn't a sound. Just as I was about to venture a peek over the top of the wall, I heard voices. Or, to be more precise, one voice, and it was Tully's. I could have heard it even if I'd stayed home at Buckshaw with earplugs.
"Never laid eyes on the bloke in my life, Inspector. His first visit to Bishop's Lacey, I dare say. Would have remembered if he'd stopped here before. Sanders was my late wife's maiden name, God bless her, and I'd have marked it if someone by that name ever signed the register. You could put a fiver on that." "No, he wasn't never out here in the yard. He came in the front door and went up to his room. If there's any clues, that's where you'll find them. There or in the saloon bar. He was in the saloon bar later for a bit. Drank a pint of half and half, chug-a-lug, no tip."
So the police knew. I could feel the excitement fizzing inside me like ginger beer, not because they had identified the victim, but because I had beaten them to it with one hand tied behind my back. I allowed a smug look to flit across my face. When the voices had faded, I used a bit of creeper for a screen and peeked over the top of the bricks. The inn yard was empty. I vaulted over the wall, grabbed Gladys, and wheeled her furtively out into the empty high street. Darting down Cow Lane, I retraced my tracks from earlier in the day by circling back behind the library, between the 13 Drakes, and along the rutted towpath beside the river, into Shoe Street, past the churchyard, and into the fields. Bumpty-bump across the fields we went, Gladys and I. It was good to be in her company. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in soda water. It was a song Daffy had taught me, but only after exacting the promise that I would never sing it at Buckshaw. It seemed like a song for the great outdoors, and this was a perfect opportunity. Dogger met me at the door.
"I need to talk to you, Miss Flavia," he said.
I could see the tension in his eyes.
"All right," I said, "where?"
"Greenhouse," he said with a jerk of his thumb. I followed him round the east side of the house and through the green door that was set into the wall of the kitchen garden. Once in the greenhouse, you might as well be in Africa. No one but Dogger ever set foot in the place. Inside, open ventilation panes in the roof caught the afternoon sun, reflecting it down to where we stood among the potting benches and the gutta-percha hoses.
"What's up, Dogger?" I asked lightly, trying to make it sound a little bit, but not too much, like Bugs Bunny.
"The police," he said. "I have to know how much you told them about."
"I've been thinking the same thing," I said. "You first."
"Well, that Inspector Hewitt, he asked me some questions about this morning."
"Me too," I said. "What did you tell him?"
"I'm sorry, Miss Flavia. I had to tell him that you came and woke me when you found the body and that I went to the garden with you."
"We already knew that."
Dogger's eyebrows flew up like a pair of seagulls.
"He did?"
"Of course he did. I told him." Dogger let out a long, slow whistle.
"Then you didn't tell him about that row in the study?"
"Certainly not, Dogger. What do you take me for?"
"You must never breathe a word of that, Miss Flavia. Never."
Now here was a pretty kettle of flounders. Dogger was asking me to conspire with him in withholding information from the police.
Who was he protecting? Himself? Father? Or could it be me?
These were questions I could not ask him outright. I thought I'd try a different tack.
"Of course I'll keep quiet," I said. "But why?"
Dogger picked up a trowel and began shoveling black soil into a pot. He did not look at me, but his jaw was set at an angle that signalled clearly that he had made up his mind about something.
"There are things," he said at last, "which need to be known, and there are other things which need not to be known."
"Such as?" I ventured. The lines of his face softened and he almost smiled.
"Buzz off," he said.
In my laboratory, I pulled the paper-wrapped packet from my pocket and carefully opened out the folds. I gave a groan of disappointment. My cycling and wall-climbing had reduced the evidence to little more than particles of pastry.
"Oh, crumbs," I said, not without a little pleasure in the aptness of my words.
"Now what am I going to do?" I put the feather carefully into an envelope and slipped it into a drawer among letters belonging to Tar de Luce that had been written and replied to when Harriet was my age. No one would ever think of looking there, and besides, as Daffy once said, the best place to hide a glum countenance is on stage at the opera. Even in its mutilated form, the broken pastry reminded me that I had not eaten all day. Supper at Buckshaw was, by some archaic statute, always prepared earlier by Mrs. Mullet and warmed over for our consumption at 9 o'clock. I was starved, hungry enough to eat a slice of Mrs. Mullet's icky custard pie. Odd, wasn't it? She had asked me earlier, just after Father fainted, if I had enjoyed the pie, and I hadn't eaten any. When I had gone through the kitchen at 4 in the morning, just before I stumbled upon that body in the cucumber vines, the pie had still been on the windowsill where Mrs. Mullet had left it to cool, and there had been a piece missing.
A piece missing indeed. Who could have taken it?
I remembered wondering about that at the time. It hadn't been Father, or Daffy, or Feely. They would rather eat creamed worms on toast than Mrs. Mullet's custard. Nor would Dogger have eaten it. He wasn't the sort of man who helped himself to dessert. And if Mrs. Mullet had given him the slice, she wouldn't have thought I ate it, would she? I walked downstairs and into the kitchen. The pie was gone. The window sash was still in its raised position, just as Mrs. Mullet had left it. Had she taken the remains of the pie home to her husband, Alf? I could telephone and ask her, I thought, but then I remembered Father's telephonic restrictions. Father was of a generation that despised the instrument, as he called it. Always ill at ease with the thing, he could be coaxed to talk into it only in the most dire circumstances. Ophelia once told me that even when news had come of Harriet's death, it had to be sent by telegram because Father refused to believe anything he hadn't seen in print. The telephone at Buckshaw was subscribed to for use only in the event of fire or medical emergency. Any other use of the instrument required Father's personal permission, a rule that had been drummed into us from the day we climbed out of our cribs. No, I would have to wait until tomorrow to ask Mrs. Mullet about the pie. I took a loaf of bread from the pantry and cut a thick slice. I buttered it, then slathered on a blanket of brown sugar. I folded the bread twice in half, each time pressing it down flat with the palm of my hand. I stuck it in the warming oven and left it there for as long as it took me to sing three verses of "If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake." It was not a true Chelsea bun, but it would have to do. Chapter 10. Even though we Delucers had been Roman Catholics since chariot races were all the rage, that did not keep us from attending St. Tancred's Bishop Slacy's only church and a fortress of the Church of England, if ever there was one. There were several reasons for our patronage. The first was its handy location, and another the fact that Father and the Vicar had both, although at different times, been to school at Grayminster. Besides, Father had once pointed out to us, consecration was permanent, like a tattoo. St. Tancred's, he said, had been a Roman Catholic church before the Reformation and, in his eyes, remained one. Consequently, every Sunday morning, without exception, we straggled across the fields like ducks, Father slashing intermittently at the vegetation with his Malacca walking stick, Feely, Daffy and me in that order, and Dogger, in his Sunday best, bringing up the rear. No one at St. Tancred's paid us the slightest attention. Some years before, there had been a minor outbreak of grumbling from the Anglicans, but all had been settled without blood or bruises by a well-timed contribution to the Organ Restoration Fund.
"Tell them we may not be praying with them," Father told the vicar, "but we are at least not actively praying against them." Once, when Feely lost her head and bolted for the communion rail, Father refused to speak to her until the following Sunday. Ever since that day, whenever she so much as shifted her feet in church, Father would mutter, "Steady on, old girl." He did not need to catch her eye. His profile, which was that of the standard bearer in some particularly ascetic Roman legion, was enough to keep us in our places, at least in public. Now, glancing over at Feely as she knelt with her eyes closed, her fingertips touching and pointed to heaven, and her lips shaping soft words of devotion, I had to pinch myself to keep in mind that I was sitting next to the devil's hairball. The congregation at St. Tancred's had soon become accustomed to our ducking and bobbing, and we basked in Christian charity, except for the time that Daffy told the organist, Mr. Denning, that Harriet had instilled in all of us her firm belief that the story of the flood in Genesis was derived from the racial memory of the cat family, with particular reference to the drowning of kittens. That had caused a bit of a stir, but Father had put things right by making a handsome donation to the roof repair fund, a sum he deducted from Daffy's allowance. "Since I don't have an allowance anyway," Daffy said, "no one's the loser. It's a jolly good punishment, actually." I listened unmoved as the congregation joined in the general confession. "We have left undone those things which we ought to have done, and we have done those things which we ought not to have done." Dogger's words flashed into my mind. "There are things which need to be known, and there are other things which need not to be known." I turned round and looked at him. His eyes were closed and his lips were moving, and so I noticed were Father's. Because it was Trinity Sunday, we were treated to a rare old romp from Revelation, all about the sardine stone, the rainbow round about the throne, the sea of glass like unto crystal, and the four beasts full of eyes before and uncomfortably behind. I had my own opinion about the true meaning of this obviously alchemical reference, but since I was saving it for my PhD thesis, I kept it to myself. And even though we Delucers were players on the opposing team, as it were, I couldn't help envying those Anglicans the glories of their Book of Common Prayer. The glass, too, was glorious. Above the altar, morning sunlight washed in through three windows whose stained glass had been poured in the Middle Ages by half-civilized semi-vagrant glassmakers who lived and caroused on the verge of Ovenhouse Wood, the thin remains of which still bordered Buckshaw to the west.
On the left panel, Jonah sprang from the mouth of the great fish, looking back over his shoulder at the thing with a look of wide-eyed indignation. From the booklet that used to be given away in the church porch, I remembered that the creature's white scales had been achieved by firing the glass with